This talk was recorded at the 2019 Actuarial Society of South Africa Convention at the Sandton Convention Centre. For more information on the Actuarial Society, visit actuarialsociety.org.za.
Hi everyone, I think we're ready to begin. Okay, I'd like to introduce the speaker for today. Her name is Zante. Zante is a manager in PwC's actuarial risk and quants practice with over 9 years of experience. She has experience in the UMA and cell captive industry with a particular focus on capital modeling and reinsurance modeling for the general insurance or short-term industry. Her presentation today is going to cover a practical guide to application of the credit quality steps in producing the Prudential Standards regulatory returns, and she's going to give us some insights based on her own experiences. Zante?
Thank you, Renalsha, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here. I'm really excited to present today. The presentation for me is twofold. The reason for it is twofold. First of all, on a more personal note, I fear public speaking. I'm not a fan. So part of this is the personal journey of facing my fears. So thanks for being here and the support. And the second one is probably more for you. It's an interesting topic. I've had the opportunity to both prepare the calculations for a short-term insurer for the prudential calculations, and also in the past few months to actually audit these type of calculations. And from the start, this topic intrigued me, and it still does. So before we start, I quickly just want to read you a small joke. So two people are flying in a hot air balloon, and they realize that they are lost. They see a man on the ground, and they navigate towards him. And they yell, "Can you please help us? We are lost." And he replies, "You're in a hot air balloon about 200 feet off the ground." And one of the people in the balloon says, "You must be an actuary, because you gave very accurate information, but it was completely useless." So hopefully today is not like that. Let's keep it an interactive session. There's time for questions towards the end. But if you have any comments or queries as I go through my presentation, please don't hesitate to put up your hand and we can discuss it. The idea is that it's interactive, and as consultants, we always say the correct answer is it depends. So therefore, I may not have all the answers today, but I feel that discussions usually end up in good solutions, or at least just a new perspective. So the focus of my discussion would gravitate towards the general insurance industry or calculations, as this is where I spend most of my time. And we're going to merely scrape the surface on this topic today. But I'm hoping that with sessions like this, it will encourage us as a profession to delve deeper into our understanding and through collaboration expand on our understanding and our interpretation of these things. So this is just a quick summary or agenda of what we'll touch on today. First of all, I'll provide a short background. Then we can look into more detail into the Prudential Standard guidance, both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. I'll touch briefly on some alternative approaches. Then we'll move into the live poll. So just for that, can I just see a show of hands who has downloaded the app and who will be able to participate in the poll? Okay, great. Okay, and then we'll have the results on the screen. We'll look at some of the things to consider when we tackle credit quality steps, as well as some examples, and then we'll move into the conclusion and a Q&A session towards the end. So we see credit quality steps in our SAM solvency capital requirement calculations in the FSIs. We essentially shock counterparties' exposure for default in these modules. So you'll see this is the not the full SCR module, but just the areas where these shocks are applied. And like I mentioned today, my comments and examples will gravitate towards the short-term side. So we'll look at market risk and the two items in there, spread and default risk, and concentration. And in the non-life underwriting risk, we'll look at premium and reserve risk and cat risk. So in essence, the counterparties are ranked according to credit quality steps. The shocks depend on the credit quality step ranking, and there's considerations with the FSIs also in the GOIs. So we'll jump right into the detail of the prudential standards. I have some extracts from the prudential standards for different sections, and I reference them with some commentary on that. So if we start with FSI 4.1, section 9.9, we read that the calculation of the capital requirements for spread and default risk relies on the assignment of credit ratings to instruments. And the basis on which the credit ratings are assigned is through credit quality steps. And these should reflect the long-term historic probabilities of default rather than the external credit ratings. And it allows for different external and internal ratings to be used in a consistent manner. So I've seen the notion that in here we see that credit ratings are allowed and we use it, but the aim is actually to do an investigation on the probabilities of default and not just depend on the credit ratings provided by third parties. In section 9.10, we see the interesting comment where an insurer relies on external ratings and there's more than one external rating available. Again, the historic default rates must be assessed. So the notion here is then just to move to the more prudent rating. And it would be quite interesting to see who actually does the independent investigation. And maybe there's merit to actually use less onerous credit rating. If we look at section 9.12, attachment 4, the capital requirement for spread risk takes into account the loss given default as well as shocks and factors to consider per counterparty. So in these counterparties and shocks, we notice considerable differences in the factors to use in the various credit quality steps. If we look at section 9.17, there's some more details and more numbers. The default risk for type 1 rated entities, these exposures, it's calculated taking into account the loss given default, a fixed gamma, and then a probability of default per the counterparty. So I'm pretty sure all of us are aware and familiar with this table. And this is used to take your external credit rating and match it one-on-one to a credit quality step here. So nice and easy on the short-term side, we see you start with the top rating and you work down this table and assign the ratings one-on-one. In section 9.27, we see that for type 3 cash at bank exposures, it's calculated taking account, again, a factor assigned to each counterparty. Based on a credit quality step. And here we notice the big jumps and the big numbers from credit quality step 8 onwards, which is quite interesting as this is where our banks are typically rated at. Then section 10.4 elaborates more on these steps. So the calculation of concentration risk capital requirement. So again, in the market risk module, it's step 1, excess exposure per counterparty. Step 2, then there's a capital requirement calculation per counterparty, and then aggregation in step 3, again, across all counterparties. So in all of these, there's significant focus on the counterparties and the shocks that needs to be applied per counterparty. What's really interesting for me in this one is it's not different treatment for credit quality steps each step. These are banded. So there won't be a different treatment for a credit quality step or a bank with credit quality stayed between, say, 8 and 9, but there's a significant difference in the calc in the one-step drop from 9 to 10, which can be quite significant in the calculations, and I'll take you through some of the examples later on in the presentation. Then when we look at step 2, again, there's a banded approach for credit quality steps 1 to 6, and then from 7 onwards, again, one-step approach. So really an interesting phenomenon in the prudential standards. So I just want to ask, is there any questions so far, any comments, any interesting observations someone has at this point? Okay. So when we look at FSI 4, attachment 2, insurers are required to account for default risk, and this requirement extends to the recoverables from risk mitigation instruments. So far, just maybe a consideration for banks. I mean, these calculations are applicable to your reinsurers as well. And then they treat it as type 1 exposures. So both very important, and different calculations apply on both. if we then move towards the GOIs, so the FSI versus the GOI, it sometimes feels to me as if we treat them as mutually exclusive, or the GOI is not so important as the FSI because there's no calculation that you can apply. It's judgment. It's stuff to think about. We probably think, oh, this is the board's problem. But they're actually equally important and not mutually exclusive. FSIs guide you in the calculations. So pillar one, while the GRIs focus on the governance and the risk management. And you can use your GRIs as a guidance to inform the process for your FSI calculations, and the compliance with GRI automatically improves and talks to the processes for the FSI. So I enjoy reading the GRIs, give some new perspective, and in this case, it's actually quite helpful for these particular calculations, and I'll show you why. So if we look at GOI 3.3, section 6.1, we read that an insurer must regularly perform a sufficient level of due diligence on its reinsurers to ensure that the insurer is aware of its counterparty risk and is able to assess and manage such risk. So I'm not sure who of you is reading this for the first time. Not. Okay, that's good news. So it would actually be very interesting for me to know what companies are doing in this and what the benefits are that we're seeing in this, and not just using the external credit rating. Any comments on that? Due diligence is performed and benefits from it? Okay. So for me, there's a lot of gray in this. There are three words for me that we could class as gray. The one is regularly. What does it mean? Does it mean annually? Does it mean quarterly? Does it mean when you're busy with your reinsurance renewals? The second one is sufficient. We'll look in section 6.3 at things to consider when you do your due diligence. But what does sufficient mean? Does it mean you need to consider all of those? Some of those? The third word for me is reinsurers. Is it your current panel? Is it your panel from a previous year with still some open claims? What does it entail? How far and then how much detail should you go into this, just this one sentence in the GRIs? So if we look at section 6.3, these are the things to consider when you do a due diligence for your reinsurer. So it's typically the skills and expertise of your reinsurer, claims payment records, ability to meet future obligations, balance sheet strength, funding sources and liquidity, operational capabilities, governance, risk management controls. And if you look at this list, this is typically the things that a rating agency will consider when it performs a rating exercise. So in this, the GRI actually guides us to do our own rating of a reinsurer. And this touches on the sufficient level that's considered in section 6.1. So these are all open for interpretation, but the point is that consideration should be given to this, and maybe more investigation into the GRIs are necessary. Then we skip back to section 6.2. The level of due diligence an insurer must perform on its reinsurer must be commensurate with the level of exposure to that reinsurer. And this would probably probe or force smaller insurers to actually investigate the bigger reinsurers first and then work through the rest of the panel. It shouldn't be solely dependent on third-party assessments such as rating agencies or brokers. And then it should be no less thorough even if the counterparty is a related or interrelated party of the insurer. So these all touch on nature, complexity, and scale, and definitely a big focus on independence in these ratings that we apply. I think this one is for me the most interesting one. Section 6.5 says, where the insurer is aware that a reinsurer relies significantly on retrocessions, the insurer must also identify and assess the financial standing of the reinsurer's retrocessionaires. So, yeah, there's probably scope for industry to come together in these assessments, because there's significant merit for reinsurers and insurers, and probably reinsurers brokers, to work together in these assessments to the benefit of both entities. A validated independent rating could mean more business for the reinsurer, as insurers, especially the smaller ones, would place more business with reinsurers with a better credit rating. And this could contribute to the consideration in justifying alternative approaches to get to credit ratings, as well as the consistency of credit quality steps in the market. So I think we're all familiar with the normal table of taking your rating and applying it to the table to a probability of default. So now I'll just briefly touch on some of the alternative approaches to consider. So firstly, and this probably doesn't classify as a full-on alternative approach, but there could be a banded approach where you take a few external ratings and band them together and then map them to a probability of default, so not a true one-on-one approach. There's various credit models out there where it's calculated, ratings are calculated internally, or it can be outsourced. The key thing in all of these considerations, whether you do an alternative approach or some banding approach, is validation. This one is probably more relevant for the life insurers who's already seeing some of this. And then the third one is validated internal models, where you rely on the validated internal model of a specific counterparty. So why not look at the internal model of your reinsurers, collaborate on it, and get to a point where independently it's been validated that the credit rating is probably, or can be argued that it can be different to the external rating given to that counterparty. So now I would like us to quickly move to the live poll. If you can just take out your phones. There's just four questions. And the aim is just to set the scene, to see what the audience is made up of, the representation in the market, and what's currently happening. So quickly want to see what the audience mix is. Life insurance, general insurers, banks, reinsurers, other. Okay, 60%, okay, it's still counting. Okay, I think that slowed down a little bit. So, there it goes again. Okay, I think we can talk about this. It seems to be fairly stable. So mostly life insurers. So just on the other, what others, is there maybe regulators, reinsurance brokers, some volunteers on what the other makes up? Yes? Consultants, okay. Regulator, that's interesting. Okay, if we move to question two. Is your organization aware of methods other than external credit rating? So question 2 and 3, very similar. Question 2 is your organization aware? And question 3 will be, are you using these methods? So just quickly, let's just check awareness. Is your organization aware of these methods? Okay, that's good. So majority at least aware that alternatives are possible. Okay, and then we can move on to question 3. Now that we're aware, who is using the other methods? Okay. So this is quite interesting, and I think this is what I expected. The awareness is there, it's just, and we'll get to question 4 just now. So awareness is there, but probably use of it not embedded quite yet, and we're moving towards it. So if we look at question 4, we'll get to the reason. So the main reason for not using the alternatives as opposed to the external credit rating. So first option, we have not yet thought about it. Second, we have thought about it, but we will in the next 12 months. I think a big thing is cost and resources. And the last one, purely because the credit rating approach is easy and acceptable. Okay, I think we can move on. I think we have some perspective on this, on where we're all at, what we're focusing on. So cost and resources, definitely a big thing. And if we move to, let me just switch back to the presentation view. There we go. So some considerations when you think about using external credit ratings or the alternative methods and models. So first of all, the pro with the external credit rating, and we've seen it now, it's available, it's acceptable. There's no additional costs required or resources. And the effect on the SCR, if you don't rely on reinsurers that much, or there's enough spread in your calculations, the effect on the SCR is probably negligible. The negative side is, what to do if there's more than one credit rating? Is there a consistent approach? Do we switch between approaches? We sit with the rating agency bias probably, and then the effect on the SCR could be negative. It could have a massive impact if you just stick to using the credit ratings. For the alternative methods and models, positive could be better accuracy, but this could also lead to spurious accuracy. The governance and the risk management is a key point here. If you independently assess these, there's automatically compliance with the GOIs, especially for your reinsurers. We get to an independent view, and again, the effect on the SCR, depending on the situation and the specific scenario, could either be negligible or actually a big effect. And on the negative side, as I mentioned, it could lead to spurious accuracy, and cost and resources, as we just identified now, is a big consideration in these alternative methods. Some further considerations for your company specifically. It's recommended that you have a board-approved policy on your credit quality steps, regardless of the method. Because this can touch on many of the matters considered up to now, and also outline the processes for alternative methods. A key thing is documentation, just to ensure that there's consistency within the group and within divisions, and also that it's nicely documented in your ORSA. I've seen instances where between different divisions, there is a slight inconsistency between credit ratings. When you talk about the sovereign cap, is it for disclosure? Is it for calculations? Do we use if there's more than one credit rating, which one do we use? So it's just to ensure that consistency within your organization. Definitely need to consider compliance with GOI. nature, scale, and complexity. I'll touch on that a bit more in the calculations that will come through, just to guide you towards where the focus should be. Is it necessary to do these extra calculations and investigations, and will it add value? And then frequency of updates. When do we do the updates? When we specifically use the external credit ratings? Is it when the ratings change? Do we do an annual check for models? When is it updated? When do we make changes? A key thing is, when is it validated? Who is going to validate it? And when is it going to happen in all of these deadlines that we face every month and quarter? So the ideal is for all of these to be considered in the outlined credit quality step policy, and with probably an annexure to show for which reinsurers or banks a different approach is followed, maybe with the specific ratings used. There's really no correct answer on this, but probably a good idea to have some documentation on this. And then these considerations is probably for us as an industry. What do we do with sovereign downgrades? How do we take the volatility from this? What can be done for this? What do we do if there's difference in ratings? For instance, S&P and Moody's have different ratings on an entity. How do we treat that? And what is appropriate and relevant for the specific entity? And then industry consistency. Do we really have industry consistency on credit quality steps, especially for the smaller players? It might be a big concern. And then collaboration. I really think there's scope for more of these sessions, probably working groups, maybe involving the regulator, but also just in your smaller space. We, the insurer, reinsurer, and your reinsurance broker, just on the reinsurance side, can work together to make sure that it is the best possible and most accurate answer for credit ratings for a specific entity. So now I'll take you through just three very simple examples to show the effect this can have. So the first example is the effect of a three-notch improvement in credit quality step of a main reinsurer for an insurer with a significant reliance on proportional reinsurance. And we'll specifically look at the non-life underwriting risk CAT risk module. And then the effect of a three-notch improvement in the credit quality step of a main reinsurer for a larger insurer with no significant reliance on reinsurance, with just a non-proportional structure in place. And we'll also look at the CAT risk model. And then lastly, the effect of a one-notch improvement in the credit quality step of banks of a small insurer in the market risk shock. If we look at example one, just the assumptions I've used. So we'll look at an insurer that writes property and motor with premiums of 40 million and 60 million for property and motor respectively. The NatCat exposure is 4 billion with a majority of the exposure in Gauteng. The RI structure we'll assume is a 90% quota share just with one reinsurer. So this is not very simplistic, taking away the effect of diversification and other non-prop structures in place. And the two scenarios we'll consider is scenario one with credit quality step 8 for the reinsurer, and then scenario two, credit quality step 5 for the reinsurer. So if we look at the non-life underwriting risk charge, premium and reserve risk, it does come down between credit quality step 8 and 5, but not as significant as the drop in the CAT risk from 15.5 to 11.2. And this results in a 50% decrease in your capital charge, just by making sure this credit quality step is more accurate. So there's some very simplified assumptions in here. Usually for a smaller insurer, you do see a non-prop structure in place. This would obviously have another effect, but it's really just to encourage further investigation into these scenarios in your own calculations and in your own book. Then the second example, again, property and motor line of business, with slightly higher premiums of 400 million and 600 million for property and motor. The NatCat exposure also slightly higher at 40 billion, with most exposure in Gauteng. And then here we assume a RI structure of just a non-prop, an excess of loss structure in place for catastrophes with a 20 million deductible. in a similar scenario of the credit quality step, scenario one on credit quality step 8 and scenario 2 credit quality step 5. So no difference in premium and reserve risk because of no proportional structures in place. The cat risk drops slightly, and then you can see a very, very insignificant change in the capital risk charge. So here we can see the nature, scale, and complexity argument coming in. It's probably a very unique thing you need to consider in your own calculations. It depends on the specific scenario, the specific reinsurer, the specific book, the specific scenarios outlined in the prudential standards, what is applicable, what is applied, the structures in place, the diversification between your panel. So really an encouragement to look at these calculations for your specific scenario and specific company. And in this case, insurer one would typically be more motivated to look into these calculations than the larger insurer we see in this example, for which this independent calculation of a credit quality step probably doesn't make too much of a difference. However, I will still argue to do that with to have compliance with GRI and at least the independent view of the risk you face in your counterparty. Then we can look at a market risk shock assumption. So here we look at the insurer with the asset base of 204 million, split as follows. We'll have most of the exposure in banks, and in scenario one, we'll look at credit quality step 10, and scenario two, we'll just move it up one notch in that band, into band one, credit quality step 9, and then for the equities, we'll keep it on credit quality step 7 in both calculations. So a small drop in your spread and counterparty default calculation with a significant drop in the concentration calculation. Really just making sure that one step difference is taken account of accurately. This translates into a 32% drop in your diversified capital charge for concentration risk. For market risk as a whole. So then I reach my conclusion with some key takeaways here. The prudential standards are only principle-based. It gives guidance, but it seems that overall the credit ratings are used to map to probability of default for various reasons, but it is possible to deviate from this and to use the alternative mappings and credit models and validated internal models. For me, and I think in general, it's key to remember that whatever approach is followed should be documented and validated and approved, especially when alternative methods for credit quality steps are used. It's important to keep track of when changes are made, who is responsible, and what is the process around it. The aim should be to determine the unique effect these credit quality steps have on your solvency capital requirement, not just in specific models, but in the overall calculation to make sure that it's accurate and independent. There's some considerations into whether you should consider all counterparties or just your significant counterparties. Do you just look at your banks or do you look at your reinsurers? Do we start this process just by looking at our market risk calculation or do we start by looking at our reinsurers? The cost and effort versus the wider benefit is definitely a consideration. And again, consideration into the governance and risk management, the GRI compliance. And then a key takeaway from this is industry collaboration. Many parties can play a role to understand the value add that is possible. There is scope for working groups, and the main consideration should ultimately be to get to a consistent approach within the industry. Thank you. Now we can have questions. Okay, so any questions? Yes? Oh, wait, there's one at the back.
Hi, Edmund Vigro from QED Actuaries and Consultants. I share your fear of public speaking, and well done. I think you've done very well. I also share your passion for this topic, specifically for Create Quality Steps, and I've done a lot of research into this as well. And I think it's appropriate and very important that these types of discussions should happen in the industry. So well done with that as well. You've alluded to it, but I see using create ratings, there's two ways of doing it. The one is a peer one-to-one mapping, which I think you alluded to, you mainly spoke about. But there, in position paper 111, attachment 1, there is another form of guidance that will guide you in mapping credit ratings using their historic probability of default. So if you use the studies done by the various credit rating agencies in their probability default that they saw in each credit rating that they have, I think there is value to be added to use. I would, so in summary, I think I would not tend to the one-to-one mapping. So in my research, I've seen S&P is maybe the only one that has a very close to one-to-one mapping. Mm. All the others definitely converse back away from that, where they don't have a one-to-one mapping. So I would argue that using the probability default, the actual historic probability default of each credit rating agency's credit ratings, and mapping that to a credit quality step isn't in contravention of the FSI. I do agree with you, however, for reinsurers, more work, I think, need to happen in terms of that, and I think more value can be added in that sense. But it's my view that for your normal asset exposures, investment exposures, if you do a proper investigation in your credit rating agencies, they do provide you with independence. They have an independent view of the matter. So you do have that independence. And what is more is, if you look at your market risk and you've got 100 different exposures, it's very difficult to do an alternative approach on each individual. So it does maybe come to down to cost and resources as well. Mm. That is my thoughts, maybe from my side.
Thank you. That's very valuable. Any more comments on this?
Okay. Maybe to add your point of the industry collaborating. The PA already gives us the yield curves every month. How about the PA also providing us with the
correct
credit quality steps? Yeah.
Maybe the regulator or someone representing the regulator can comment on that. No comment.
I just want to ask, is the industry collaborating actually happening?
We're collaborating today. So I think that's one of the key things I would like to see from this is to encourage the discussion. But I think we're already in a space where there is probably inconsistency in the market, and it probably would add value to, like with the SAM process and the SAM implementation, to have maybe revert again to some working groups, and it doesn't have to be as regular or as formal, but on specific issues in the prudential standards that we now sit with and have to comply with, to have these and to have volunteers to see that happening. And it's, I think, especially for the smaller guys, I think the effect of these calculations is more severe for the smaller players, and to actually see the smaller players participate in these workshops and volunteer groups.
Was there a question? I was just wondering whether you couldn't apply to actually create a working group on this and run it, because, I mean, it will be really interesting, and I think we just need one person to volunteer and drive it forward.
It is a consideration, and I mean, we at least two people here that's passionate about this, so why not? Any other comments and questions? Is another one in the middle? Sorry, first at the back.
Sorry. I mean, the main one, obviously, that is a concern is the banks for a lot of us smaller players.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was hoping for PwC's view of where they see the banks being rated at. Obviously, you have a view. You audit your companies. You're doing, suppose, some half worth, maybe. So, like, is there a view? Because there's that 9 to 10 step that is a definitive impact on a balance sheet and on a capital calc.
So although I stand here as a PwC employee, I'm still just Zante with my opinions today. So it's very difficult for me to give you a view as to what it is currently and what the correct answer is, because this area is so grey. But it comes down to the independent investigation and talk to your auditor and talk to your consultant about it. Have the conversations and get the view. There's probably a range of correct answers, but it's also difficult to answer given it's different scenarios, unique situations. So it's probably best to take this offline and we can discuss it further. There was another question here in the middle.
Zante, this is maybe just asking for your views. But Zante, if you're not the PwC view.
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at the sort of credit ratings that we're getting from the ratings agencies, you know, one could argue that they have far more access to management and a far greater detail that they can actually get hold of to assess an entity's creditworthiness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you then take it from an external perspective, so insurer A in South Africa, you know, trying to invest in, or placing money in Bank X, you know, what is the degree of, you know, additional information that insurer A would be able to really get out of Bank A, you know, the bank that they're going to be putting money in relative to the credit rating?
Yeah.
So if we then look back to the independent process, what real benefit will there be? And, you know, what material difference would we expect if they, you know, versus using a credit rating?
It's a very valid question, and I've had it before as part of my research. And I've seen companies do stuff on banks. So there's definitely value to add. There's definitely more benefit in the independent calculation. And I think in some instance you do end up a little bit with the rating agency bias. How big it is, I don't know. But if it has a big effect on your calculations and it does bother you, it is probably a good idea to look into it and investigate it a little bit further. Companies are doing stuff independently of the rating agency, so it does happen and there is benefit from it. Yes?
So it's a similar theme to a lot of the other comments and questions, but I mean, it just strikes me as strange for all the companies in the industry to invest time and resources, come with a credit rating, and you've got the same counterparty and you're trying to get the same answer, and you come with different ratings. You know, so it just strikes me as it will save the whole industry time and effort to just
have it in
do
one
it for
point.
The industry as a standard default. And if companies want to deviate from that for whatever reason, they can do that. But, I mean, ultimately, reinsurer A and Bank A should have a consistent credit rating. You know.
So what I get from this is probably a need for the regulator and industry to come together in a working group type structure to just discuss this further and get to a consistent point, a central point of information. One more.
Yes, I was just wondering, have you ever seen anyone come up with a higher credit quality step when they do their own assessment?
No. I personally haven't seen it, but if that is your independent view, go for it. Thank you. I think that wraps it up. Thank you very much. Thank you for the participation. This was quite interesting, and hopefully we discuss this more. And if you have any other discussions or comments, we can take it offline. Thank you very much.